This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show!
This episode of Best of the Rest is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible is the leading provider of audiobooks with over 200,000 titles to choose from. Go to nerdylegion.com/audible, sign up for a trial membership, and receive 2 free audiobooks. That's audible.com.
I don't think we have an agenda or an outline or anything tonight, do we, Jay?
No, not that I'm aware of.
All right. Actually, I thought we might go back and revisit what we were talking about the last time about, like, when do you plagiarize art?
Oh, okay. Well, I did some research on that.
Okay. Are you recording yet?
Yeah, I'm recording. I've been recording.
Before we even get into it?
Yeah.
Oh. Introduce us with your silky smooth radio voice.
Okay. All right.
Super smooth.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Best of the Rest. We're here with Dennis, my regular podcast partner, and joining us tonight, special guest Paul Tessner of the Comics in Black and White podcast, and Paul and Michael, whatever else you
want. Yeah, those two.
Okay.
Whatever just those two right now. In. And you could check those all out on nerdylegion.com/whatever the episode names are or podcast names are.
So. Oh, it's late in the day, late in the weekend, so we're just trying to put thoughts together.
Yes. Not always easy to do.
I don't remember coherence being a requirement for this podcast.
Oh, you mean for the network or the podcast?
Either one.
For the whole network, yeah, really.
Yeah, I mean, the more popular the podcast, the least coherence is required.
Oh, so that gets you more downloads?
Exactly. I mean, look at CTT being on top there. I mean, it's Martin. You know it ain't coherent.
Ah, that's just sheer volume there. Nothing but sheer volume. It's like stuff in the ballot box.
Yeah. I do have the number 2 podcast, so you know that I'm barely coherent.
So... anyway, I thought tonight we'd kind of revisit that the subject Jay and I were talking about last time, and I don't know if you'd have heard about it or not, Paul, but...
Well, no,
you know,
that episode hasn't come out yet.
So. Oh, it hasn't come out yet, so this will just follow up on it. It hasn't been out yet, so...
I can just pretend I've heard about it.
Okay, so how exactly did it go, Jay? Because we were discussing how you could plagiarizing writing was a bad thing, but plagiarizing art wasn't.
Okay.
Or how was it? How did we lay it out?
Well, to remind everyone and to bring Paul up to speed, we're talking about the Vault Comics. They have started doing on their, when they do their second prints of their number one issues, which their number one issues are all selling out. But what they're doing are homage covers to famous comic book covers of the past. And the one we were specifically talking about was Wasted Space. Because they came out with a couple of different variant or a couple of homage covers for their reprint of the number one. One of them was an homage to Action Comics number one, and the other was an homage to a Crisis on Infinite Earths cover. And we were discussing, got into the discussion about, well, where does homage end and plagiarism start? And I was kind of wasn't sure at the time, so I'm like doing a little bit of research. And basically what I have found is that if you don't copy the character, in other words, if you don't put a man that looks like Superman, copy any of the characters, you're not plagiarizing. There's no plagiarism. You can't, in other words, you can't copyright a pose or a situation.
But again, aren't you setting up a bunch of stuff that apart mean nothing, and then when you put them all into this, you organize them all into this pattern on paper, that's different from a character?
I'm not sure I'm following what you're saying.
Well.
Okay, so let's take this Wasted Space cover. it's got the character of the, you know, the fuckbot, who's holding this green space vehicle above his head. He's smashing it into a boulder, and you've got these aliens that are running in all directions. Now, it is exactly the same pose, I guess you want to call it, as Action Comic number one, but nothing is the same. You know, the character that's doesn't look like Superman. The car doesn't look like the green. The aliens that are running it, scattering in all different directions, don't look like the villains that were on Action Comics number one. The colors are not. So there's nothing. You've not copied anything. You've not interfered with anybody's intellectual property. Arrangement. Different characters in the same arrangement, which is not plagiarism.
I've got a whole bunch of thoughts on all this, but I'm going to listen to you guys a little bit more first.
Oh, you want to listen? Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, but why couldn't it have been a red rocket ship or a blue one? Why did it have to be green? Why did it have to be? Why did he be holding it up and crashing it in? I mean, you instantly recognize that it's Action Comics 1, even if there's not a Superman there. So, right. does the art that was created, you know, just all the parts together is art, not just the character.
Correct.
Yeah, but that would be like saying the 10 things I hate about you is plagiarizing Shakespeare. It's using certain beats that are the same to create the parallels so that way you can recognize it, but providing enough differences that it's not just literally copying. I mean, you know, if you wrote 10 things I hate about you and literally just it was Taming of the Shrew, that's what it was. And it was just Taming of the Shrew, that would just be plagiarizing it. If they're literally just doing it, and then be like, why don't you just call it that? I mean, I guess there's no not copyrights on that because it's, public domain, because it's so old, right? So, I mean, like, you have to have the things to relate it there. My question with when doing an homage cover is, I mean, like, are you guys just talking about, like, technically when is it legal and when is it illegal? Or are you talking about when is it a good thing to do and when is it a bad thing to do?
Oh, it just came up in conversation. I love the homage cover, so I just want to make my point. It's like, I love them. They're great and all that. But, you know, at some point, you know, you just figure some artist or some company is going to get irate with some artist that does an homage or something.
Yeah. Did you guys see on Twitter? I forget why I saw this. Somebody else retweeted it, but Rob Liefeld got upset about somebody homaging one of his covers.
Maybe that's what it was that got me thinking about it.
He wasn't too hot about it. Like, I mean, he was, he basically said, like, yeah, you know, you should be giving me credit for this. And I remember what it was, because he said he wouldn't sign them unless he was given a after Liefeld on the art, which is, like, due course. Like, you should do that.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely think that, I mean, that was an example where, and he wasn't given credit, and you should give credit from where it's drawn from. Like, Dennis, you know, you actually sent me the Todd McFarlane cover that the only reason I even knew that existed is because it was homaged for a Ninja Turtles cover.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like, I think sometimes it's awesome.
Yeah, I think it was Incredible Hulk 340.
Yep. Yeah, the one with Wolverine reflecting Hulk in his claws, and an artist as a variant for a Ninja Turtle issue did Casey Jones Shredder reflecting Casey Jones in his blades. Rich Woodall was the artist who did that. So for me, like, when I came across that the first time, you know, I just thought, oh man, that's an awesome cover. But then, of course, on the cover it says after McFarlane, because that's what you do when you do it right, is you are paying homage to who you're drawing it from. So like, that was really cool. It paid due credit for it. So like, I'm with you where, like, if it's done well, then I think it's really cool. Let me tell you about an instance where I think it's kind of a crappy thing to do. And so have either of you checked out the recent few releases of Cerebus?
No.
Yeah, I got the Cerebus and Hell, the first four issues of that. And then I'm kind of like, eh. And then they started doing, like, the Batvark, and
that's where it got screwed up. Yeah, Cerebus and Hell was an interesting concept for, like, how to for him to get stuff put out there. Like, I can get him doing this stuff to, like, not only put something new out there. I mean, he's a creator and he needs to make money, and I guess he has, like, problems with his hands now, so he can't.
Yeah, that's the one thing I was gonna say. You have to put out there. I don't think he can currently draw.
Yeah, exactly. So he came up with a creative way, like Cerebus and Hell. It was creative. You know, it was quirky, but like I got those. I read them. I enjoyed them for what they were. But when he started doing the Batvark, and then he has one that's an homage to Superman, to Action Comics number one. I know he's had a few of them. Well, I got the first one, the Batvark one, and he had literally two pages of new content. The rest of it was reprints of Cerebus and Hell. And then the next one comes out, and it was the same thing. Like, two pages of new content, the rest was reprints of Cerebus and Hell. So, like, to me, that's an example where, like, he was doing homage covers, which is cool. And, like, if you really love one of those homages, you know, like, if you did an homage to Ninja Turtles number one, I would still pick that up, even though I'm kind of pissed off about how we went about this, just because, it like, that'd be something that just for the cover itself would be cool for me to have if I liked it, you know? But the way he released it, and then it was basically getting people to buy something without really being clear of what the contents was, and the contents was nothing new. So it just was totally screwed up, in my opinion. So that's at least the one instance I could definitely come up with where I think homages can be manipulative. It really all depends on what you're doing with it. Like what you guys are saying about Vault doing the homages for the reprints of number one, that sounds like a pretty good idea, because you're going to get the people who already bought it to potentially buy it again just because you're doing an awesome homage cover. But then that's also going to catch the eyes of people who maybe wouldn't have checked it out the first time around.
Oh, no, I think it's great, because I ended up getting, I usually don't get second prints and all that too much, but the Vault, the Deep Roots number issue one, they did an homage to Swamp Thing 7, that Wrightson cover. Where you've kind of got Swamp Thing from the waist up, and he's kind of half turned, and it's just, and it's all green and everything. Oh, it's just so awesome looking and all that. And I think that's what they're going to start. And it looks like that's what they're going to start doing with all their second prints. So, or a way to go, Vault, because I know one thing that's going to boost their visibility. And I mean, they're actually putting out some really good stuff. I'm getting all the Vault stuff now, and it's on great comic stock, and they're doing all science fiction and fantasy, which is, you know, I've kind of switched from Capes and Cows into kind of that genre, and, you know, smart move, whoever thought of that at Vault.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool idea. Yeah, I haven't read very much Vault yet, but I know I've heard all of you guys talking about it, you know, in the chat and stuff like that. And Jay, you sent me something. I can't remember off the top of my head what it was, but I either still have it in my stack to read. I think I still haven't read it yet, actually. It's on top of my next batch of Jay's box of comics to read.
I'm trying to think of what it was. Probably, what is that? The game? I can't remember how to pronounce it. Began with a Z.
Oh, Zojaquan?
Zojaquan. I think I sent him the first couple of those because I didn't want to keep reading.
You didn't? After you get the whole, I think it reads better as a trade, because once you get the whole thing, well, after the second issue, when you figure out what's going on, it makes a lot more sense and it gets a lot more interesting.
Okay. I may have to go back and try that.
Well, let me give you the overall synopsis. So what happens is, I don't think you're ever given why, but this woman ends up on another planet or another plane or whatever. And she's jumping through time, but she's jumping forward to time. And so when she first gets there, there's these creatures, right? And so she does some stuff to save them and everything like that. And then she jumps, I don't know, several millennia or whatever, and they've advanced. So they've become bipedal, almost human-like creatures, but now like Stone Age. So then she teaches them to farm and teaches them how to use tools and everything and advances their civilization. Then she jumps ahead again, and now they've got language. And so you see her jumping in time, and every time she comes back, she helps this alien species advance, and they start to think of her as a god or a protecting angel or something. And so you kind of see how that plays out, almost like the monolith from like 2001.
It must have been kind of a slow build up because like I said, I read the first two issues and I didn't get any of that.
Yeah, the first issue, you don't get any of it. You're just kind of like, huh. But you're kind of taking it from her point of view because she doesn't know what's happening.
Right. Okay.
So that might be one of those that reads better as a trade. But once you get the whole story, it's actually pretty good, I think. So I think you'll enjoy it, Paul.
Awesome. Yeah, it sounds pretty interesting. I haven't, like I said, I haven't really checked out much from Vault. I haven't been in too much of trying new comics place until more recently. It's funny because the couple things I started picking up are actually Big Two books, which usually aren't what I would go out on my way to get. But now that I have a Patreon for Comics in Black and White, I got a couple of people that are patrons. So I'm getting just enough basically to get two comics a month now without it coming out of my regular budget, which is still pretty tight. So I started picking up Venom, and I picked up the first issue of Hawkman to check it out. So at least they're kind of, I mean, I guess Venom's kind of a popular character, even though mm-hmm. he hasn't had a lot of titles, but Hawkman's kind of out there character-wise. So,
are you getting it from your LCS?
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, and maybe this is, you know, another discussion, Jay, because I think we had somebody, I think Jack was talking about he went all digital, and I think you made the comment, it's like, well, I'm not going to pay full price for digital when I can get 40% off subscription.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with that too. Like, I can't pull the trigger on going digital for new releases. Like,
yeah.
I'm digital to a big extent. I love Comixology, and you guys both know that that all three of us have dug getting Hoopla.
And that's the one thing Vault, I don't think, is getting anything on Hoopla, and I think they're missing some eyeballs there.
Yeah, Hoopla really does good to try stuff out. I've tried a lot of things that I never would have that, you know, as my budgetary limitations change over time, like I'll be more willing to go out and, you know, pick up physical copies to have it. Aftershock is like that too. Like Aftershock, their Comixology sales suck. Like they're barely discounted, so you can't get any really good Comixology deals. They're not on Hoopla. I was able to pick up a couple of trades of Animosity from the library a while back, but like I've been wanting to read Baby Teeth because everybody was yammering about it, and you know, Donny Cates is doing all sorts of stuff that everybody's digging. And I actually just totally randomly found that used at my comic shop for $3 because it was a banged up copy of the first trade. So I picked that up so I could finally read the, you know, the first trade worth of that. But yeah, it's just, it's hard to branch out to some of these smaller publishers. Like even being able to listen to you guys talk about them, it's hard when you can't like actually read it and kind of give that little test drive yourself, you know, without having to blow $4, which, like I said, I'm picking up two comics. I just said, you know what, these are drawing my interest enough to make me take that much of a shot on it. But when you go to a small comic shop, if you're not asking for it 2 months in advance, if it's a small publisher, you ain't getting it. So it's like those things don't come across my, you know, my line of sight, because there's no way other than if I was subscribing to them.
Yeah, but isn't part of the issue, though, you got your small independent comic publishers and they need the revenue from paying full price for the comic?
Oh, yeah.
To kind of stay in business? So
yeah, and I don't even think that they should, I don't know. Like, if there was some way for it to be easier for them to get, like, here's a whole issue to read across to people to some extent, then I think that, you know, for me, and this is just like kind of a newer situation for me where I'm even starting to mentally branch out again. You know, if something comes across my plate, like it has to catch my attention a little bit. If I give a one issue read, like you really get a feel for how it is. It's too bad that like, like Valiant at my LCS, when I was getting Valiant, the only Valiant he got was literally what was being ordered by people. So it didn't hit the shelves. That's just how it was. Like Valiant wasn't going to get spread out to anybody that way. But then, you know, Valiant, when they have a Comixology sale, it's like half off or a buck an issue or stuff like that. So that way it's, you know, pretty cheap to dip your toes, but Vault also, how long have they been going for? They haven't been around that long, have they?
I don't think it's been quite 2 years. It might be a year and a half. I think the first thing they put out was Heathen, but I also know that Heathen was a Kickstarter or a digital, wasn't it, Jay? And then it got reprinted with Vault into print. But yeah, the thing is about that first release of Vault, if you go to their website, you can't find anything on their first releases. Like I think last month both Heathen and Failsafe got optioned for movies or TV. And if you go to their website, and maybe it's changed since I've last been there, but there's nothing on Heathen and nothing on Failsafe, and I don't even think the last two issues of Failsafe have even come out, cuz I can't find them.
Right.
But they're optioned, and then they're not mentioned on Vault. So it'd be interesting to see what their business. I wonder if their business model is kind of like your Image or your Aftershock where they facilitate the creators? Or is it more like Black Mask where they facilitate the creators, but there's no deadlines or anything? It's just when you get it, you get it, and we'll publish it.
Okay, they were founded in 2016. Right at 2 years, maybe not quite. So.
Yeah. I know the big thing with Vault at the beginning was a lot of speculators were really diving into their stuff because they had the heavy card stock, and they were submitting comics to CGC, and they were getting 9.9 and 10.0s on submitted comics, which, you know, there's some people collect those. They don't care what the comic is, but if it's a 10 or a 9.9, they got to have it.
Well, that's interesting too, because it, like, with you, what you just said about Failsafe and Heathen, if they get optioned and that takes off, because, you know, we know that getting optioned doesn't mean that much yet. I mean, no. It's kind of like the potential for success, but you know, not any kind of guarantee. I remember I got the first issue of Outcast. I think the first six issues of Outcast, and I read them, and I wasn't too enthralled by Outcast. Like, I thought it was a little just too slow paced and didn't pay off much at the end of the first arc. Mm-hmm. But then I heard that it was getting optioned for a show on Showtime, and then that show even came to fruition, and it just never mattered. Like, it didn't affect anything. Even once the show came out, it's almost like the show coming out made people just finally stop talking about it more than anything. But yeah, with those 9.9s and those 10s, if either of those shows do come out and either of them hit or popular, those are going to be super valuable.
Yeah, well, I think the problem was there was like quite a few of them, so they're almost skewed the curve. So the 9.9s and the 10s for that may be more readily available. I think they're still rare.
So we should be CGCing the alternate comics then, like the real cheap print ones.
If you hit an 8, I think you're lucky. Well, I tell you something that I heard got optioned or something and recently that I'm hoping to see that I haven't heard much from lately, mostly because the company got bought by Boom, was Mouse Guard. The original by Archaea.
Yeah, Boom bought Archaea, didn't they?
Yeah, and so ever since they've done that, I haven't really seen much from Mouse Guard, and that was really great in a day. And I know he self-published the first issue, and there's only like 1,000 of them out there. Or no, only 300 of them out there, and they go for about $1,000 each.
Wow.
And then they reprinted it, and then they started putting it out, publishing it. And I know the first issue of that series is probably online raw for about $70 to $100 now. But, you know, that's something I'd be exciting to see, hoping to come back and everything. Of course, you know, they're the ones, Archaea, I don't even know how you pronounce that, A-R-C-H-A-I-A. They've been publishing a bunch of licensed, like, Jim Henson stuff. Like, they were doing some Dark Crystal, and they were doing some, they're currently start in the middle of a series from Labyrinth. And I think there's a second Dark Crystal series coming out here starting soon, but, their genre of stuff's really good. It doesn't quite fit with the Boom stuff, though, but Boom owns them, so that's it's like they're almost an imprint now of Boom, so.
Yeah, it's kind of like IDW buying Top Shelf. You know, Top Shelf books still kind of have that Top Shelf vibe. But, you know, I guess it's good them being bought out by a bigger publisher that's not one of the big publishers, because it gives them sustainability, so you know that stuff they were doing has a better chance of staying around.
Yeah, I wonder if it's kind of like, you know, like DC's got Vertigo, or they're redoing Vertigo, and I don't even know what Marvel has, but you have those separate imprints where you can just be different. Mm-hmm. Try stuff, I guess.
Yeah, like Image and all their imprints. It took me a while to figure out what the heck was going on there, because I didn't really know that existed. But like, there'd be Image, Shadowline, or this or that. You know, it's the certain like wings of Image, I guess, that are, you know, I don't know, the imprints of the certain big publishers. You know, like, but Shadowline is Kirkman or something like that. Does that mean that it like? Those are just his books, or he's involved with those creators, and he's like selecting what gets to go on that line.
Are you talking about like is it Kirkman? Is that like, isn't that Skybound or whatever?
Skybound, that's it. Yeah, yeah. There's different. Yeah. There's Skybound. I think Shadowline is one. I don't remember which one Shadowline is. I've just kind of been getting the drift of this a little bit, and I just realized that Image is more confusing to me than I ever thought.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. I think there might be. Well, I know Image is set up to where you isn't it where you come and you have yourself and your artist and image just, okay, we'll publish it, but you got to take care of everything else. So maybe if you get, maybe this is just the, like, middle management for that. You know, if you're part of Skybound, then Kirkman will take care of some of the other stuff for you, and you can just concentrate on the story and the art, I guess. I don't know. That may be something we have to take a look into.
Yeah, Image is definitely, there was a, I forget where I heard it or read it, but kind of about how their structure is and how they set it up. And I was actually pretty impressed by it. Like, they really do set it up to where it's up to the creators to succeed. And I guess, you know, they still have the option of killing a book if it's not doing, but it's kind of like, you know, I guess the creators take a portion of the risk, but you know, it's like, it really is set up to where, like, if they succeed, like, they're going to get a lot of success out of it. There's a different structure for how the floppies are, just, you know, like, I think with the floppies, Image takes a flat amount of money, and then if it sells like crazy, that's all on, you know, you get the increased profit. And I think with trades is where it changes up a little bit, which would make sense, because, you know, then it's like a sustainable enough story that it's actually getting to the point of being published as a trade. So I don't know how that's structured. But I was pretty impressed that, like, with the floppies, it's like if something sells like crazy, that's just, you know, all that increased profit is going to the creators. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I can see that give you some incentive there and everything, but I don't know. I guess I don't understand what they consider success, because it can't be numbers, because they're still printing Savage Dragon. I don't think that gets too many large numbers. But I guess if you're original founder of Image, you can just sell one copy a month and they'll keep printing it.
Yeah, if you're an original founder, quality has mattered for a long time, because you started in the 90s. You just do a pornographic variant cover to make your money, I guess.
Well, I don't know. Well, yeah, or I don't know. He's been having some pretty interesting covers lately, hasn't he, Jay? Did we lose Jay?
Either that or he wandered off to get a drink.
No. Oh, there he is.
He got bored and wandered off.
Apparently.
No, I'm still been trying to recover from the fact that somebody actually wanted to do an homage to a Rob Liefeld cover.
Well, okay. You got to remember, they didn't credit Liefeld, so they weren't even homaging it. They were just trying to steal it.
Oh, well, that's even worse. So as an homage, is that you just don't draw feet and throw some extra pouches on, and then it's an homage.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I don't even remember anymore.
Yeah, I forgot. We've kind of moved on.
Savage Dragon covers. That's what we're talking about.
Oh yeah, Savage Dragon.
Oh gosh, I don't know.
You remember, what was that one? Remember that cover we were going over in previews like a month or so ago, and I finally saw it on the rack, I think, a couple of weeks ago, where it's the shaving commercial?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Bald is Beautiful?
Yeah.
So I guess we've mentioned it. We kind of got to describe it for our listeners and Paul. So do you want to describe it there, Jay?
You go right ahead.
Okay. Well, anyway, it's like him and his girlfriend are advertising a shaving cream. So he's got the cream on his head, because he's going to shave his head bald, and she's got the shaving cream on another part of her body because she's going to shave it.
Yeah, it's a kid-friendly comic book cover. I remember when we saw that.
Oh, it's not that bad. She's just shaving her bikini
hair. It's not that bad, but it's not that good either.
But it's very suggestive.
Anyway. So what you're saying is Larson's kept it classy.
Exactly. I like Larson, though. You know, he just doesn't give to whatever's.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, there's a niche for everything too, you know. So, like, I know when the censored cover was coming out for the, what issue was that, like the 500th issue or something like that?
I know which one you're talking about, but I can't tell you what the, has he even gotten up to 500 yet?
And maybe it's not that, but whatever that was, he did the special variant cover that you know, couldn't even be advertised, had the censor bars all over it. Some people were excited about that, and, you know, definitely not my cup of tea, but, you know, some people just, you need something to you know, stir up interest, I guess.
How's that different than the triple X cover Bs for sex criminals?
I don't have those either.
they have various artists do.
Yeah, I mean, it's same thing, you know, some people are going to find those interesting. be excited about them. Yeah, I mean, Zombie Tramp exists. Like, every issue of Zombie Tramp has a bunch of different covers like that. The most interesting thing the first times I looked through previews was, okay, so they have all these covers of, like, Zombie Tramp is a good example. And, like, the variant covers, the only difference is they keep on removing more items of clothing.
Oh, then you haven't gone through the Boundless section of previews. Where they keep removing more clothing, and then they keep changing the situation.
Yeah, no, I've seen those in there, too, yeah. Yeah, yeah, none of those are going to be my cup of tea, but...
Nope.
Something for everybody.
You know what? Yeah, they have their following. So
exactly.
I wonder if any of those are homage covers. Can you imagine an homage cover like that to, like, the Spider-Man 300? That you see? That you, I think that is, like, one of the most homaged covers, so a Boundless version of that. Oh.
I mean, I only bought one of those.
Boundless comic?
No. I'm going back. I don't talk about
Zombie Tramp.
Never mind. Go ahead.
So you bought an issue of what?
I bought one of those XXX sex
criminals
issues. Yeah. And the only reason I bought it was because of the artist. It was Jaime.
Yep.
And I wanted that one. And it's not that bad. The front cover isn't. Front cover that Jaime drew. The back cover that Gilbert...
Well, you know what? It's a creative... I guess it's something that most comic book artists don't get to draw that often, so it might be an interesting change of pace for him.
You haven't read Love and Rockets. Gilbert, he draws whatever he wants to when he wants to. It's pretty
cool. Oh, you know. Oh, speaking of which, I just saw there was either an auction I was looking at or a Craigslist listing or something recently that I saw where they had a Love and Rockets issue number one for sale in the lot. And I was debating going for it or not.
Was it the self-published number one with the black and white cover, or was it the...
No, it wasn't the black and white cover. It was the color cover where it looks like it's a lineup of them dressed up in superhero costumes.
Yeah, that's the first Fantagraphics edition. Yeah, the first one that they did was a black and white self-published, and they had to put a dollar cover price on it and tried to... First, sell it by hawking it at conventions. That damn thing, you can find it signed. I don't even look at the.
Is that one of your holy grails? Is that one of your grails?
Yeah, but that won't ever happen because.
You never know. Well, you never know.
True.
You know, it's like if you hadn't gone to Chicago and went to Dallas, you might have gotten one of those Batman 457s. Yeah. So what's one of your grails that you've been looking for? That you've always wanted to get, Paul, whether or not you can get it now or not, but you'd have to seriously consider if you saw it.
I got a few things that would be grails that definitely right now wouldn't even be. I probably wouldn't even be able to afford to go to a place where I could see it at the moment. But
but it's fun to think about it.
Yeah, the obvious one for me would be TMNT number one,
first print.
They've
got several prints.
Yeah, well, the first print. Now I want a fifth print, you know, nice and affordable. Now I definitely a first print of that would be a holy grail. But it's like my the shop I go to now, the owner is a huge TMNT fan. He has most of every published issue, but he knows even for him, like, there's no way that he's ever going to get number one, because even if he got it, the value is just too much. Like, you know, it wouldn't be worth keeping for the value that it hold. So I can't imagine a scenario right now, at least, where even if I was given a copy, where I wouldn't sell it because the money would be more useful in a big way in my life than the value of the comic. But anyways, that's an obvious one. But a couple other ones is Giant Size X-Men number one, and then X-Men 94. Those would be a couple that I would love to have. And then the Hulk issues that are the first Wolverine. What numbers are those? Like 340, 341, or another
180, 181, 182.
Okay.
It's you know, that, and that's when you get into that whole discussion of what's a first appearance, because he appears in the last panel and says something. I can't remember if it's the last panel or the last couple of panels, a Hulk 180. But then he's in the entire book in 181, and that's considered his first appearance. And then he's in the first one or two panels as he's leaving in Hulk 182. So he appears in all three books, but there's a drastic difference between 180 and 181.
Yeah. So, those would be awesome. I had something to say and I just totally slipped my mind. I was looking at, I'm sitting by a hummingbird feeder and this hummingbird was just chilling right there and it was,
hey, there you go. What about, distracting. What is that one? Albedo issue number 2? First Usagi Yojimbo?
Oh, that'd be an awesome one. I have the first issue of Usagi Yojimbo thanks to you. That's not even that expensive of an issue to get, but you'd picked it up and passed it on to me.
Yeah, but it was Albedo or, yeah, I think that was and I can't remember, was that a Fantagraphics? Was Usagi with Fantagraphics before they went to Dark Horse?
Yeah, yeah, and there were 7 trades worth of stuff on Fantagraphics. It was like a decade worth of material on Fantagraphics. But the first appearances that he were in, an anthology comic, basically.
Yes.
So that's the kind of thing, that would be very cool to have, obviously, and if I got it, I'd be very happy about it. But that wouldn't really be a grail for me.
No, it wouldn't.
Yeah,
as much as you like Yojimbo.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the fact that the first issue of Usagi Yojimbo is affordable.
It's also a nice cover.
Yeah, that's the one that I would want because it's him, you know? I mean, what's going to be on the cover of the. I can't remember what you just said the title of it was.
Usagi's on the cover.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, that would add to it for sure, but yeah, you know, I wouldn't want to pick up some book where Usagi's not even on the cover. He's buried in there somewhere. But if he's on the cover, that's a little bit different. I don't know. I don't have a ton of grails because I had a little foray into Uncanny collecting not too long ago last summer. You know that because I was talking to you all the time about it. But aside from that, I've had to just completely break the collecting habit. Mm-hmm. So when you do that, it's you have your couple of those would be nice. But it's not as extensive because I don't have all these collections I'm pursuing where, for you, if you're pursuing, I don't know, a dozen different collections at the same time where you're constantly looking for those things, you're going to have more grails because there's going to kind of be a grail for every thread, you know?
Yeah, that's true to a point. It's I'm currently doing the Marvel Star Wars. And they're not too bad of expensive, that's more kind of fun. What do you mean? Wait a minute.
Have you stopped doing for a while you were looking first Silver Age appearances of villains in Batman?
No, I still look out for that, but they're kind of, they're really kind of, I'm not going to say they're expensive right now, but I've got Poison Ivy, I've got Two-Face, I've got Penguin. You know, I'm kind of, I don't know when the first Silver Age Joker was, but that's probably expensive. I think it's, but yeah, I've been looking for Riddler and Scarecrow, and the Riddler stuff for some reason right now is very popular and it's, I don't know. I need to wait till it lulls down and everybody's really expensive on the Scarecrow right now. So, but
Hellboy would be another one for me.
Oh, which one?
The first issue of Hellboy.
Not the San Diego Comic-Con one?
Well, I don't know that exists yet. I've never pursued Hellboy from back that far from a collecting perspective.
I actually saw one of those in a half-price book, CG Seed, with Magnolia's signature on it. And they wanted, I think, $500-$600 for it.
Hmm. I wouldn't even have an idea offhand how much that would be worth. Yeah, that's something I love Hellboy. You know, I'm thinking of for me, I mean, just like you were just saying with the Batman villains, it's the characters that resonate the most with you that would draw you in. For something long running like that, for me, Uncanny X-Men, that's why Giant Size X-Men would be probably the biggest holy grail for me because it's the origin of so many of my favorite characters, Nightcrawler and Storm. Plus there's other origins in it, obviously. Wolverine is one of my three favorite X-Men are Wolverine and Nightcrawler and Storm. I don't care how much most people have had Wolverine burnout.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't experienced the burnout because I, didn't read comics in the 90s. That helps. even since then, I know Wolverine is still overexposed in comics. It doesn't matter to me because I don't read them all, you know? But I love going back to, the beginning of Claremont's X-Men run and all that. I love Wolverine as a character. You know, so those guys.
As he was then. I don't know about currently. Back then he was mysterious. You didn't know his past. He didn't care what anybody thought about him.
Yeah, that's when he was the best, you know. You don't have to let it be ruined just because as time has passed, they've overexposed all of his past. They've given, that origin story they did where, you know, it's like he's not even the guy you thought he was. He was the other, you know, he was like the rich guy's kid. I read that. Like, that was an entertaining read. I don't really care how it relates into everything else necessarily. I read Old Man Logan, like the Millar Old Man Logan. That was good. It doesn't necessarily have to matter to me, like, how the stories is kept going and going relate in. Like, right now, I'm happy going back and reading Claremont. I've read a little bit. Like, I read the Frank Miller Claremont miniseries. That was the first Wolverine series, and that was good. And I'm going to be reading when it starts being an ongoing series, but I'm trying to wait until I get up to that point in Uncanny X-Men and kind of read them both, like, issue by issue.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, just Wolverine back then was so great, and who cares what they've done in between now and then? Like, if you cared about that, like, how would you like any comics
been
going that long?
True. Yeah, so you mentioned Millar, and I know the first issue of his first Netflix-backed comic came out, which was interesting, but I'm wondering if there's going to be a kind of a tonal shift in those books coming out, since they know they're going to be like turned into TV or movies or whatever on Netflix and everything. Are they all going to be interrelated, or I don't know. And I don't even know what the output's going to be. I thought the Magic Order was pretty good and everything like that. For a first issue and everything. I haven't even watched a trailer yet, so I still got to do it. But I'm wondering how that's going to influence. Well, I don't know. Millar's always kind of written more for TV and movies, his books, as opposed to actually as comics. So I don't guess there is going to be much of a change there. But it was interesting that it still had the Image logo on it. Yeah. I almost thought that was going to be separate from Image, but I guess not.
Interesting. Yeah, my enthusiasm for that has dwindled as series of Marvel shows on Netflix have been less and less interesting. I got all excited about comic properties on Netflix, and then over time they've lost my interest. Like, I love Daredevil season 1. I really like Daredevil season 2. Jessica Jones was good, even though it took me a while to get through. Iron Fist is where it started going wrong for me.
But is that because a lot of the comic book-based shows have been more capes and cowls or superhero? Because, like, the Magic Order, I mean, it's not really like your typical superhero comic. So it's being translated into both. And I think you're starting to see a bunch of places now start to try to get, you know, like Vault, a bunch of their stuff, and that's not comic related. And I want to think there was some other stuff I heard, like we were talking about Mouse Guard and other things. So I think the independents are going to start seeing a bunch of stuff now because it's not your typical books, and I think that's what people's wanting to start to see from comics. And it's almost becoming like comics are the proving ground for ideas and concepts, and how you used to do storyboards for movies and things to pitch them, and now you can just go do a comic and it's like, that'd make a great movie.
Yeah, well, Eric Heiser talked about that when we had him on the Valiant Central podcast before we killed that. We had him on talking about Secret Weapons, mm-hmm. and he was saying even there that a lot of times screenwriters, they'll go and write a comic to get basically to get some sustainable or proven source of material for the movies they want to do. It's like they'll shop an idea that they have, or shop, you know, a screenplay they have, and studios just won't be interested, but they make it into a comic, and then there's something substantial to show at that point. So I think a lot of the screenwriters you're seeing writing comics, I guess it's kind of hard to tell, because there are quite a few. I mean, especially looking at Valiant, like that little window is kind of an interesting indication, because you have quite a few guys who have written for Valiant that were screenwriters primarily, and then also wrote for Valiant. And you kind of wonder, with each instance of them doing that, is it like that's something that to do kind of on the side while they're their primary focus is the Hollywood stuff. Like Heiser, even though like he is really busy with his movies, his love for what he did with Secret Weapons is super apparent. Like, you know, he's dripping with, how important that was to him for what it was, not because he was wanting to make it into a movie. But then other guys like, you know, Kibble Smith writing Quantum and Woody. Hey, I mean, he's doing it because that's what he wants to do, I'm sure. But he also, you know, isn't raving about that the same way that Heiser was about Secret Weapons and working with Raoul Allen and Patricia Martin.
Well, I wonder if that's because now that you're getting these books they have extra content, and you can actually see what the writer wrote, that it looks like, and I don't know if this was true in the past, but it almost looks like how you write for a comic is like a script you would write for a movie or a TV. You gotta, you sit there and you set the stage for the artist, what they need, what's in the scene, and then you have the dialogue. And it seems like you can almost, what you write for a comic, you could just almost translate and just hand the same document over to a director, and they could direct the scene, or an artist can draw it in a comic.
So on a little bit of a tangent here, and I know this is technically DC, but did either of you guys read Commandy Challenge at all?
No, I did not.
I didn't read it either, but that's okay. It doesn't really affect the story.
And on that note,
So Commandy Challenge was like, I think it was like 8 issues long that they did it. And I forget the whole story with it, but I believe that each issue was written by a different writer, and then there were different artists involved. So, mm-hmm. Some to that effect. I don't know all the details. You guys honestly probably know better offhand better than I do. But there was one issue that Kevin Eastman worked on the art with it, and he worked on it with Freddie Williams. I always flip-flop Freddie Williams and James Tinian. One's the writer, one's the artist. Tinian's, I think Freddie Williams is the artist? Tinian's okay, the writer. So yeah. Freddie Williams, then. He did the Batman TMNT crossover art. So they worked together on Commandy Challenge. And what was really cool about it is back when Eastman and Laird were doing Ninja Turtles, you know, did you guys know about how they did the art for Ninja Turtles? I'm guessing you do, Dennis, because we've already talked Ninja Turtles some.
Well, refresh me.
Okay, well, basically they used duo shading to do what they did. And off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you the specifics about what it is, but it had to be used with a specific type of paper, and then they did certain stuff to it, and that's what gave the classic TMNT books their look. It was like a very specific kind of process that like isn't really done anymore, and I couldn't even give you another example of it being used.
Is that why they were also like magazine sized or oversized?
Yeah, pretty much. Like that was the size of what they were using was different than traditional. I believe that's why. And I can check with my comic shop owner about all this stuff because he is the biggest Ninja Turtle nerd you'll ever meet. If you meet him, come up here and meet him. Come on.
Does he collect stuff other than just the comics?
He has a giant Ninja Turtle statue in his store that he bought from Steve Levine, who had Shellback Artworks, and Steve Levine worked on the original Ninja Turtle stuff.
Yeah, but so there's all the action figures and the playsets and the video games, and
I don't know what he personally collects, but when he opened his shop, I know a lot of, like, pretty much all of his personal collection besides Ninja Turtles went into the shop as merchandise. So as far as other stuff like that, I'm not sure what he personally collects, but... but anyways, one of the things he does have, he has quite a few pieces of original comic art in his shop, and pretty much everything is for sale, but there's a couple that are not. And one of them is a page from Commandy Challenge that Eastman and Williams worked on together. What's really cool about it is they did it like Eastman and Laird did. They used some of that original paper that Eastman had still from when he worked on TMNT, and they were sending it back and forth, working on it together, just like Eastman and Laird did. Because when they worked together, it wasn't like one of them did the pencils and then the other one did the inks or something like that. They would literally pass pages back and forth, both contributing to everything that they did. So it's just really cool because he has that up in the shop, and it's cool to see that like Eastman did that with somebody totally different, you know, kind of in modern comic art. And they basically took the same process for doing it as the original Ninja Turtle stuff.
Oh, nice. But All right. So to take it back a bit, so no, Jay, I am still looking for some of those books. I'm just, you know, you just kind of keep an eye out and you jump on the opportunity when it appears. But you got any grails that you keep an eye out for? Oh, I actually got another copy last week, too.
Which one?
First print newsstand.
Okay. With the Indicia error?
No, without the Indicia error.
Without the Indicia error, okay.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Yes.
On the subject of Batman 457, there's a great example. Why is that a grail for you guys?
Okay. This is an interesting... Because there's actually six versions of this comic book. This is back when they were doing two different prints for one for direct market for the comic book stores and one for the... And they put out the first print of this. And they made a problem... They made an error with the Indicia, which is that block at the on the splash page. It gives all the legal information. And it gives the... number of the comic book. Well, I had an Indicia error. Instead of 457, it said 000. So that was one version, and they had that on both the first print newsstand and the first print direct market. That's actually the most common variant. Well, it's not really called a variant. People call it a variant, but that's the most common version of it. So then they reprinted...
Then you had the versions where the Indicia does show 457.
Yeah, the Indicia does show 457. So now you've got four. There's four of your versions. And then they did a second print, which the only difference in the cover is they added a banner on top that said First Robin issue. This is the first issue where Tim Drake appears in costume.
Officially as Robin, because earlier he donned the Jason Todd's uniform to save Batman, but he wasn't officially Robin at the time. But this is like his uniform when they get rid of the leotards and the bare legs, and he actually it looks like a suit as defense. But it's Tim Drake, and it's the night. So this is actually the reason I like it is because this is the Robin. You know, when I really started getting into comics, this was my Robin. And that's the other thing that makes this issue great is because it's the first Tim Drake officially as Robin. But continue, Jay, because you're getting into the interesting part now.
Anyway, so they did the second print, and they did the same thing, a direct market. The difference you can tell is direct market versions just have where the barcode is, a little rectangle, just has a bat symbol. But the second print are exceedingly rare. In fact, for a long time, people thought they were a myth. That there was none of them existed. There were none left. And then a few started to show up, and then their numbers were saying, oh, there's only 8 of these in existence, and then it's kind of gone to 12 and 16, and there's still fewer than 20 that have been documented.
So basically, Paul, it's just a rare version of Batman comic, but it also happens to be like the first Tim Drake officially as Robin.
And see, that's the part that I never knew. I never, like, because I've heard you guys talk about it some, but you've always only talked about the specifics of the scarcity of it. Yeah. So that's what I was curious about, was like, was it a holy grail because of the scarcity alone? Was it because of another aspect of it?
Yeah, it the scarcity is the big driver. And I've also got to look, and then there's some early Batman... I gotta go look, but I think it's like in the early 300s or the early 400s where there's Whitman variants. And those are pretty rare too. And there's nothing special about those issues. It's just, you know, it's the ones that were sold in a poly bag in a drugstore. But and they didn't have the DC logo, they had the Whitman logo. So the only thing is it's a variant, but it's not the same content, and the cover's just different from that. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, is it really a big deal? No, but you know how collecting is.
Yeah, well, totally.
It's the same thing with kind of like with Detective Comics 881. There's nothing special about the content of that issue. It's not a first appearance of anybody. It's not the last appearance of anybody. There's nothing specific, but that became wildly popular simply because of the cover art by Jock. Drawing of the Joker that's mostly it's a composite of dozens and dozens of small bats that make up the face of the Joker, and that just became insanely popular.
And, oh, it's still popular, and it keeps going up. You keep doing eBay sales that people have on it, and they just keep jacking up the price. But that's an interesting thing, because I'm seeing a lot, and this, I guess it's from the speculation side of things, that a lot of comics now, popularity is being driven by the cover art.
Yeah, and that's where that takes us full circle. Go back to homage covers is a great way to draw people into a comic.
Exactly. And I'm going to, you know, and to get back to it, I think I'm going to start getting all the Vault second prints because of that, because they just look really nice. And they're really well done. You can get some homage covers that are really bad, and then some that are really well done. But then some you get overdone, because I don't know how many they are of, like, the Spider-Man 300 cover. But you got certain people that collect only those covers that look like that.
Exactly. You know, having collected Valiant for a good number of years, and that was kind of, I guess you'd say, my formative comic years. So I learned a lot in those years, kind of changed my approach or method quite a bit. And now I've completely receded back to, like, I'm just like getting comics to read for the most part at the moment, even though, like, I have that strong collecting impulse that I must fight at the moment. But seeing how Valiant variants have done, and seeing, you just nailed it with the quality of the cover art being a big factor. There's been scarcer Valiant comics that, like, may have some value because of the scarcity, or at least the ratio variants. You know, like, some are really scarce and are really scarce because they were a high ratio variant for a short printed book. But then some have, like, had bigger print runs, but they'll still be, like, such a high ratio variant, but people just don't care still because they're a dumb variant, to be, like, blunt about it. Like, the black and white version of the A cover. Like, who cares? It's not pencils. Like, it's just black and white. You just took the color away. You know, see, it's all, like, computer drawn. So, whoop-de-doo. But the ones that have done really well, and that, like, will entice me even to be like, man, I wish I could own those, have been the ones by really good artists, like Adam Gorham variants that have been, like, 1 in 50 variants. He did those for Divinity. Those always were more valuable, and they were fantastic covers.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Johnson covers. The Dave Johnson Britannia covers were, I believe, 1 in 50s, and those were ridiculously valuable. I mean, in contrast to other Valiant comics coming out at the time, I should say. Because obviously, like, you know, a few hundred bucks or a couple hundred bucks for a cover is nothing compared to plenty of things. But, it's definitely a big factor between the quality of what you're getting and the scarcity, like, those two things combined. You know, so, like, what you guys are saying about Batman, what was the number? Sorry.
457.
Yeah, Batman 457. Super scarce, and that's going to drive its value, but then you throw in the fact that it's the first of that version of Robin, and then you have the emotional attachment to it, too. And I obviously have no idea what the cover looks like, because I honestly don't think I've seen it. I should probably look at it sometime, since everybody talks about it all the time. But you have those two factors, and the cover was an awesome cover on top of that. It would just drive it even more.
It's not a bad cover. It's Batman hanging upside down with spiders on him and Scarecrow with a hand on him.
Cover, but it's not a great cover either.
Yeah. There's worse covers.
Well, yeah.
I'm going to say it's an above average cover.
What do you guys think? So, totally random cover question. What do you guys think of the cover of from the Nightfall run of Batman where Bane's breaking his back over his knee?
Is that a
Kelly Jones?
Yeah, I think that's Kelly Jones.
I'm a huge fan of Kelly Jones. So.
Didn't he say he's getting a new miniseries?
Yes.
With Batman?
I somehow missed that, apparently.
So is he, like, in his... How old is Kelly Jones?
I have no idea. I got to look that up. But because I just found that out this afternoon.
Yeah, because I don't think I remember seeing that, like, a month or so ago.
It's in the current previews, but I just now started from...
Now, what would really get me excited if it was a Perro getting a Batman mini?
That would be really exciting.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Well, darn. Well, I guess that tells you how much I know about Batman artists. You sure? I have to look. I have to DuckDuckGo this.
Dude, just imagine how well that would sell, though. I mean, Batman drawn by a freaking zombie? Hell yeah.
Well, what if it was like they just found some, you know, old drawings, documents of this complete story, and now they're going to publish it.
Son of a bitch. Kelly Jones is younger than I am.
Is he?
Yeah, almost a year younger than I am.
Oh, man, he died. Jim Aparo died in 2005. Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right.
I would be excited to see it. I didn't realize Kelly Jones was that young. So he was,
well,
man.
Crack. He can start. He can keep cranking out books here for the next 30 years.
Yeah.
Just getting started. He's a baby in the business.
So what's he been doing since the 90s?
Not Batman. He's been doing a lot of not Batman.
Not Batman.
Dark Horse.
Well, he's got a very distinct style.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think of that cover specifically, though? So, like, you both went like, ooh, Kelly Jones, but, like, that cover. How does that strike you? So when I started reading comics, I've had, like, three phases of reading comics. And the first one was pretty short. The second one wasn't real long. And then when I moved to Maine and I took over a store that was really stressful and I couldn't focus on reading novels, I started reading comics. And I would go to Bull Moose Comics and I would get graphic novels because their new books are 35% off. And if you can find a used book, it's cheap because it's way further discounted. So I read a ton. Like, Batman was the first thing I focused on. So I didn't really know what to read. But I was picking up anything that looked like, I guess, noirish would be the best way to describe it. But kind of like the darker Batman, you know? Mm-hmm. But then I read a bunch of, like Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale books. Like, the ones like that, that were kind of more, whatever. Those type of Batman books. But then I came across Nightfall. And I've always been drawn in by large collections of things, and Nightfall is like some nice, thick graphic novels, you know?
Right.
And that's the first, that's probably the first, like, monthly Batman books that I've read that were collected. Like, everything else is published as a graphic novel, or, no, that's not right. They weren't published as a graphic novel, but you could tell they were written to be a graphic novel, right? But that was just written to be a monthly series, and there's a very different feel between those two things.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, reading that, when I got to Bane breaking Batman's back, because I knew that that was an aspect of the story, but just that cover really struck me the first time I saw it going through the collection. I was just curious, because, like, I've never really thought about it that much, but it's a not an expensive book.
I remember, like, $8. And I remember back in the day when everything was leading up to that, I mean, that was kind of the buzz. That was after they'd killed Superman, though, right? It was they killed Superman, and then it was they were going to break the bat. Yeah. I think that was the secret. So it was this. I don't know. I remember just being a buzz in comics at the time because, like, DC was doing all this stuff to their, you know, 50-year-old characters. But continue on, Paul.
So what did you guys think when you saw that cover? Because for me, it was a cover that was like, ooh. Like, the image really catches me. How does the image catch you guys?
Same way. I mean, I find people are not... There's not much middle ground with Kelly Jones. Either people like him or they don't. Because his style is very macabre.
And exaggerated.
And exaggerated, yes. And I've even had people say, well, how can you like Kelly Jones, but you don't like Liefeld? Well, I've got a number of reasons for that.
Feet.
But, you know, I mean, he does like one of the things you notice on his Batman, the ears of his cowl are ridiculously long. You know, they stick up 2 feet above his top of his head, which, you know, is not at all practical. He couldn't go through a doorway or anything without getting caught on it. But it's just his style, and he drives this very, you know, dark, macabre style, which I like. I mean, it engages me, and I like it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I really liked the cover back in the day because that was back in when the covers were almost a part of the panel from inside the comic. You know, saw most of the time if you saw the cover that cover in some aspect would appear in the book. So when you saw it on the cover, you knew it was going to happen. So, I mean, you know this is leading up to it, and it's like, well, are they really going to do this? They're really going to do this? Then it hit the stand, and it's like, yep, they did it. And you saw the cover, and so you just get the book, and you're just, like, anticipating getting to that page or that panel where they're actually going to show what happened.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
But also to segue earlier, so it was so that Nightfall was so popular at the time, they started doing, they were doing their second and third prints of all those issues. And I know back in the day, you always wanted the first print, but now all the value that you're seeing is all in the second and the third prints. So those are more valuable than the first prints for people looking for them now.
Yeah, because they're shorter runs, right?
Like, yep, they, shorter
they print
less
runs each time. Yeah.
Yep. And then you also get that aspect of the newsstand versus the direct also.
Have you guys seen the commission that I got that was an homage to that cover?
Yeah, I believe so. Isn't that your avatar in Discord?
No, that's well, it was at a time a while ago. I don't know what that kid is now. I switched to something else, just changed it up. But yeah, that's how much that image always stuck with me. I like Batman a lot. Like, Batman's definitely one of my favorite superheroes. He was the first one I read for a reason. But it's not like he's, you know, like now after years of reading comics, the X-Men I mentioned, you know, are probably a little bit above Batman in my estimation as far as just the characters that I love the most. Batman's character I like a lot, but I wouldn't say I love him anymore at this point. Yeah, he's still a great character, but that image always stuck with me so much, and I always, always wanted to get a commission, like, homaging that, but involving the Ninja Turtles. And when they did the Batman TMNT crossover, at first I was going to do a commission with Rocksteady breaking Batman's back as an homage to that, because, like, oh, that'd be great. And then right after that was the issue in TMNT where Rocksteady and Bebop, as you thought at the time, killed Donatello. So I was like, well, that's even better. So I was able to homage that with something that was, like, right out of the TMNT comic, basically, with Rocksteady breaking Donatello's back. So I love that, like, that image has always stuck with me that much. But I also love that it kind of ties together, like, two big aspects of my my comic geekery. You know, it's like the thing that really drew me back into comics was Batman. That's what kind of got me to stick around. And then I discovered the new Ninja Turtle series, and eventually I was able to kind of connect those things up.
You know, I want to think that is a cover that's been homaged quite a bit. Which issue of Batman was that? Was that Batman 493?
I do not know.
I know it wasn't 500.
No, it wasn't 500.
Was 500? Well, no, it's 497. So it's Batman 497, and so we go to homage covers, and wow, there's a lot of them.
How are you looking this up?
On the DuckDuckGo machine. Oh, there's a version. Oh, look at that! Detective 740 is a homage where Bane is breaking the Joker's back.
Hmm. Yeah, that's funny because I have literally never seen an homage of that cover.
Oh, yeah. There's
not
that
I'm surprised it exists, but I never even thought of, like, Googling an issue and homage and seeing what happens.
Oh, yeah. So, and then there was one in the New 52, The Dark Knight, issue 6, is a, well, it's Bane breaking Batman's back again, but it's like every time Bane appears somewhere, that it has to be like he's breaking his back. Batman's back.
Bane's in the story. Let's have him break somebody again.
I don't know. I'm not finding what you're...
Well, you just don't know how to DuckDuckGo. Look up the Tech 740. And you know what? I think that's a Kelly Jones cover also. Well...
Wait a minute.
No.
An homage is on cover.
No, it's not. It's, I don't know who that is. Why not? Why couldn't you homage your own cover?
Well, I guess you could, but I guess you could self-homage.
I don't see why not. So hey, Paul, back in the day, wasn't there a rip on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, like Adolescent Hamster something?
I know. So I actually have a comic that that Rob Mullen sent me. He was the admin for the Facebook Valiant fan group for quite a while, a friend of mine. And it's a squirrel homage to the first TMNT. But I know that there were many other things that were... you know, riffs on TMNT.
Well, I think they were the ones that kind of set off the success of TMNT back in the mid-80s is what set off the whole indie. It moved, indie comics from, like, your underground comics to everybody then figured they could self-publish, and I think that kicked off, like, a bunch of things. Now, I know Poison Elves, one of my favorites, they kind of came from TMNT and Elf Quest? ElfQuest.
Yeah, I mean, some stuff predates it, like Cerebus predates TMNT. But I mean, even if you look at like kind of where Cerebus stands now, it was very, very self-published, you know, by Dave Sim, and like even still now is like the only way you can get Cerebus digitally is essentially buying it from Dave Sim and getting the digital files. It's not that they're unfindable, but the Cerebus phone books, like the collections of the Cerebus work. Mm-hmm. It's not like you just go walk in somewhere and find all of them on the shelf by any means. Like looking around for them, you can find them, but you got to kind of look different places to find different volumes and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, that's the whole reason I started Comics in Black and White on, honestly, was, I wanted to talk about, you know, as a huge Ninja Turtle fan, I did not want to just do a Ninja Turtle podcast because Ninja Turtle is popular enough that like, if you try to go into that niche, like there's already so much stuff there. And I have no interest in getting tied into a giant fan group either. Just the concept of it is so interesting to me of kind of like how they did what they did. That's one of the things that makes TMNT so great is like not only that I'm entertained by the concepts that they've run with, but just the story of how they did what they did and how they got success. And then to see like kind of what grew from there was pretty awesome. So, I mean, that's why I started doing comics in black and white was because of that. And then, eventually it didn't work to keep going with it because it was too hard to try to read enough stuff kind of in that, you know, niche of stuff, mm-hmm. To do a regular podcast. So, you know, shelved it for a while and now I kept the title and reasoning for the title be damned. But, yeah, it's just super interesting to me that. And then the first Ninja Turtle movie, at the time it came out, was the highest grossing independent movie ever when it was released.
I remember that.
Yeah, so it's really interesting to see the success of Ninja Turtles and kind of the how it came about. And I mean, it also kind of set the tone for something that was creator-owned and self-published being being something that was made for any creator to come in and run with too. As the TMNT series went on, like they had all different kinds of creators coming in and doing stuff, and it's kind of been that case ever since. Like it was a kind of like Hellboy, where Hellboy, like every Hellboy book has Mike Mignola's name on it, you know, and yep. all the offshoots. But you know that when it's like Mike Mignola and whoever writing, the other dude's doing most of the writing. Mike Mignola is just kind of, you know, being a part of it. It's kind of like now with the TMNT books that Kevin Eastman's name is on them. But, you know, Kevin Eastman isn't sitting down there and writing the bulk of the script. Like, he's just a part of the process, which is, you know, awesome still.
And here I found it. It was Adolescent Radioactive Black Belt Hamsters.
Yep.
I wonder if that was in 1986 by Eclipse Comics.
Yeah, it's so funny. Like talking about homages, it's so funny how like something like that comes about, and it's, you know, it's, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is an outrageous concept if you just look at the like the basics of what the concept is, of course. And then you think about like they were basically such a big parody of like Daredevil, among other things. You know, it's the foot instead of the hand, Splinter instead of Stick. Like, that's how they got all those things. Like, very directly got all those ideas. And then you have these other, you know, these other publishers that are, like, taking this absurd idea that, like, was basically an absurd parody of Daredevil and Ronin and, like, all these other things. And then they're just, like, going even more absurd with a bigger parody of it. And yeah, it's just funny.
So is parodies actually homage, or are they just is it just making fun of stuff?
I think it depends. Like, if you're doing it you just nailed it. Like, if you're doing it to make fun of something,
mm-hmm.
then it's a parody. Because you're not, there's no reverence for it, you know? Like, if you homage a cover, it's because you know it's a great cover.
But if you're parodying it, I guess is there ill intent in a parody? Or where there's not in an homage?
Yeah, I mean, ill intent is a way to say it, but, you know, like, a parody is, it's there not to say, like, look at this because it's great. It's there to say, like, let's make fun of this thing. You know, like, Mad Magazine is a, you know, ton of parody there. It's like, if you have a, you know, a parody to Action Comics number one, but there's, like, boogies coming out of Superman's nose, it's not there to, like, say, look how great this cover is. It's there to be like, let's make fun of this shit, you know?
Yeah. Well, what if it's like, you know, how Liefeld just recently made Pouch Man? What if it's somebody else been made Pouch Man to make fun of Liefeld?
That'd be a parody. With Liefeld doing it, it's kind of poking fun at himself, so it's just freaking awesome. Like, you gotta appreciate it when somebody can poke fun at themselves, but it's, like, if you were somebody else doing that, you know, it's a very, very difficult balance if you're trying to do something like that and not just be a jerk to Liefeld. So, but him doing it himself, it's like, obviously, he's, you know, he's poking fun at what's easy for people to poke fun of at him. I listened to a podcast recently. It's one I've been listening to, but it was a specific episode. It's War Rocket Ajax. I listened to it before I started making podcasts, then I kind of stopped when I started making podcasts, and I recently started listening to it again. Mm-hmm. And it kind of reminded me that comics are supposed to be fun, and made me stop thinking so seriously all the time about comics.
Well, that's only after the CCA in the 50s. Before the 50s, comics were not fun. Right, mean? Jay? What do you mean?
I don't. What do you mean not fun?
Yeah. Well, you had all like the horror comics, and they were more adult driven, weren't they? They were more entertainment and pulpy than they were
adult. Well, dark, but I wouldn't say I wouldn't.
That was super
that
fun.
For fun. Yeah. I mean.
Yeah, you don't go see a horror movie because you feel like you deserve to scare yourself. Like, I need to punish myself, so I'm going to go get scared. No, you watch a horror movie because you enjoy getting scared. You know, same with those comics, but. What I'm referring to is, like, doing podcasts or being a comic fan. I mean, just look at comics Twitter, you know. So many people are so serious about everything, and it's like you either have to hate people that are being progressive, or you have to hate people that just want to enjoy things the way they were, you mm-hmm. know. Like, everything has to be too serious. Like, you do a comics review podcast, this is the royal you, like everybody, you have to come off as being smart. Not just like, I just enjoyed this. And War Rocket Ajax is one where, and I think a lot of like us on Nerdy Legion do this decently. Like, we're out for our own enjoyment, like making these podcasts or anything else. Like, none of us are making these podcasts to, you know, get any kind of a deal somewhere, or, you know, make ourselves known in a greater sphere of things. So we're just talking about what we want to talk about. But it's easy to get caught up in like, sounding, you know, a little more savvy than you are, you know, not enjoying this stupid stuff that's out there. I don't know if you guys listen to comics in black and white since I started redoing it, but I mentioned, I did an episode recently where I just mentioned that I decided, it's on Hoopla, so I didn't spend any money, which is why I was able to take the risk, but I downloaded Hack Slash, which is absolutely nothing anybody would ever expect me to read. You know, I don't really dig horror. I don't really dig the stuff that's like exploiting the sexiness, you know, like comic wise, you know, I don't know, like I'd be embarrassed to go buy a comic that had like an explicitly sexual cover of any sort, you know, but there's a difference between that and like downloading something and reading it a little bit. And I enjoyed the hell out of that for a little bit of it. And then I got kind of bored because it wasn't really my cup of tea, but, it was just nice to be like, you know, this is stupid fun for a moment and not serious, you know, like, I don't have to not like this because it's stupid fun. And War Rocket Ajax, like, they're a podcast that kind of reminded me of that, you know, they were like Milk Wars. Did either of you guys read any of Milk Wars?
I did not.
I did.
Oh, you don't sound that thrilled about it, Jay.
I was okay. I mean, I wasn't my favorite thing. It kind of led into the current iterations of the Young Animal stuff, like Eternity Girl, Shade, they were all involved. Mm-hmm. Those characters were involved in Milk Wars.
Yes, I haven't read it yet, but I actually just downloaded it. But, like, just listening to them talk about it, like, they just thought it was freaking, you know, hilarious. Or, like, there were things about it that they loved, and it was just because it was stupid fun. And, like, yeah, sometimes things just need to be stupid fun and not be, like, serious is good too sometimes. But like, I love Sheriff of Babylon. There's one that like is a really serious book, but I really liked that book. So sometimes you need some of that, but man, it's just nice to be like dumb and fun sometimes too.
Well, that's true. And I don't know if this has, you know, some of the people we know, I'm not going to come right on names this time, but don't really care for a lot of the, what they call, and I hate this phrase, but I can't think of another one to use, the slice of life comic. I hate that phrase. But, you know, things like Lemire's Essex County, Roughneck, you know, those things tend towards a little more serious. You know, they're not raucous fun. And they deal with, you know, some pretty serious subjects. And I'm wondering if some of that is what people don't care about them, is because they want more of the fun. You know, just sort of nothing to take me out of the day-to-day aspects. Outrageous and fantastic.
Yeah, and I think you're right on it. Like, everybody looks for something different from comics, and it's not always the same thing that each person looks for. Like, there's a variety of things that we look for. And, you know, some of us want some real serious, this is real life stuff from time to time. And some people don't. And that's, it's just like, I don't watch the news because I don't want any piece of the news. Like, I don't want to have to dwell in the realities of our world right now. Like, I got enough to dwell in just in my own little life, you know? But with comics, like, I can read something like Sheriff of Babylon is real heavy, and I can appreciate that, you know, for what it is. But then there's other people who it's too much for them, or they just don't enjoy it, and that's fine, yeah. You know? Whereas, like, you know, we're talking about fun comics, like, you know, there are fun comics, and there are comics that aren't slice of life, but are horrible, horrible things going on. Well, and some people really dig that, and I cannot stand certain comics like that. Like, my best example is Crossed. You cannot look at Crossed and say, Crossed is just raucous good fun. Crossed is horrible, horrible things happening from the little bit that I read of it. But some people really dig it, you know, and if that's their thing. Like, my cousin is a dispatcher for, you know, for 911, and he gave me good perspective on it that kind of it made me think about it in a different way. And like he was saying, for him, like, he gets exposed to horrible things on a daily basis at work. So for him, like, to have something out there that like is actually able to like make him feel something beyond that is actually something he looks for. You know, like that actually does get to him in a different way. Whereas to me, it's just like, this just, no, I don't want any of this, you know? So it's really interesting. Everybody's going to have different things that not only that appeal to them, but like different tolerances for different aspects of things too.
Yeah. Well, that was just kind of an example, like one aspect, but it doesn't, you know, those things can't be fun. You know, for myself, I have to have, if all there was superhero cape and cowl stuff, I would, plus if it was all stuff like Lemire writes in Essex County, or Roughneck, if those were all there was, that would old after. So it's sort of a variety of things for me.
And, you know, and I think you're starting to see that translate into the movies. I think you're starting to get more studios and all looking for other stuff than the superheroes to translate over. And it's like you were talking earlier, a comic makes for a great storyboard. You can kind of see what the interest and it is, and it's easy to translate over.
Well, guys, I hate to bounce out early on you, but I just realized what time it was, and I got to start getting my son ready for bed.
Yeah, and I think we've been at an hour and a half, so I think we can probably wrap it up anyway.
You got packing to do yourself.
Yeah, I got to.
Yeah, the wife pack.
Yeah, she's already come down and gave me the evil eye, so.
I have not gotten the evil eye. That's why I didn't realize how late it was getting.
So. Okay. So anyway, no, it's been a fun conversation. So where can everybody find you, Paul? What all are you doing?
I am on Twitter at Who's Paul. You can check out my two podcasts. Go to NerdyLegion.com. The podcasts are Comics in Black and White and Paul and Michael Occasionally Save the World, that I do with Michael Sparkman, who is also of the 2BT podcast on the Nerdy Legion Network. So check those out. You can check out my Patreon on patreon.com/comicsinblackandwhite. And you can tweet those podcasts specifically on Twitter also, but you might as well just tweet at Who's Paul because that's easier.
Yeah, and I'm at Oot Inger, and I actually did a tweet this week that kind of got a lot of surprise because people actually saw me tweet.
Shocking. Absolutely shocking. But, it was good.
I'm still trying to figure it out. I'm slowly getting there, but I'm at Oot Inger. I can read them. I may not respond, but I definitely read them.
I'm at Jay Forgets, or you can tweet the podcast directly at BOTR Comics. Thank you, Paul. We appreciate you coming on with us.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on.
And that's a wrap.